Good morning and welcome to Dropsides weekly live stream. It's Tuesday, August 18th. I'm Sherif Abdul Quddus. We have a packed show today. A little later in the broadcast, my colleague Julian Andreoni will be talking about today's primary elections in Florida. We'll have two of the candidates on with us, Elijah Manley and Oliver Larkin. We'll also be looking at the case of a family in California, a mother, father, and 16-year-old son who've been held in ICE detention since April. They're all legal permanent residents of the United States with valid green cards, but they've been separated and held in immigration detention for the past 4 months because of the actions of a relative nearly 50 years ago in Iran, what they've called a bloodline punishment. But first, we're going to turn to Gaza and talk about the latest developments. President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, traveled to the region for high-level meetings with Hamas leader Khalil al-Haya in Cairo on Sunday, followed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday. And this is all supposed to be about the next stages of the so-called ceasefire plan that was proposed by the United States. Now, it's important to back up for a moment to give some context. 10 months ago, October 10th, 2025, a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas went into effect. This is phase one of a deal that both sides agreed to, which included ceasing fire, the exchange of captives, allowing aid and life essentials into Gaza, and an initial Israeli withdrawal from parts of Gaza. Hamas's disarmament was not a part of this phase one of the deal. Now, since that agreement, Israel has violated it on a daily basis. It has continued attacks on Palestinians in Gaza on a routine basis. Over 1,260 Palestinians have been killed over these past 10 months, including at least 300 children. That's an average of a child a day being killed by Israel. The pace of killing has also been gradually increasing. In July, the health ministry noted that 152 people had been killed during that month, making it the highest monthly death toll of 2026. So there's been this steady escalation. Israel has also not allowed in the agreed upon levels of humanitarian aid and life essentials. They've blocked the entry of reconstruction equipment and shelters. They've refused to fully reopen the Rafah border crossing. And they have gradually pushed their ground troops further westward, taking more and more Palestinian land from what was supposed to be an initial line of withdrawal that was about at 53% of Gaza. They're now controlling closer to 70%. So, and by all measures, by the United Nations, human rights groups, and of course, Palestinians themselves, the genocide is continuing in Gaza. It has not stopped. Now, last month, President Trump announced that a roadmap for implementing the next phase of the Gaza ceasefire had been agreed to by Hamas that included a plan for it to hand over its weapons. The following day, Hamas confirmed it did agree to a deal, but it stressed that implementation of the deal would only proceed if Israel fulfilled its obligations under the first phase of the agreement. So it said discussions over handing over its weapons were conditional on a permanent end to Israeli attacks, a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, early recovery and reconstruction, the entry of a Palestinian technocratic committee and international forces, the dismantling of Israeli-backed armed Palestinian militias, and progress towards Palestinian self-determination and an independent Palestinian state. That's what they agreed to. The response by Israel to this announcement was to conduct a couple of days later one of the heaviest aerial assaults on Gaza in weeks, killing 18 Palestinians in a single day, hitting healthcare and medical facilities. Then a few days later, Netanyahu officially rejects the deal that was proposed by the US and announced by Trump, saying Israel would not withdraw or end its attacks until after Hamas fully disarmed, a stipulation that was never agreed to. Trump's Board of Peace then reverses its position and backs up Netanyahu's narrative. Fast forward to this weekend, Jared Kushner meets with Hamas leadership, including its newly elected head, Khalil al-Haya. And the next day, he meets with his longtime friend, Netanyahu. And he emerges from this meeting with the Israeli leader with basically nothing. no concrete commitment by Israel to the U.S. proposal that Hamas agreed to. Instead, Kushner comes out in an interview on Fox News and declares that they have issued Hamas a 60 to 90 day ultimatum to surrender its weapons before Israel withdraws or does anything in return. And he says if Hamas doesn't do this, doesn't submit unconditionally and hand over its weapons, quote, everyone will see that they're not genuine about peace and that Israel will have a lot more support from the United States and others to go and finish the job in the appropriate way, end quote. And we don't know what finish the job, what that ominous language means, but one can imagine. So that's just a very condensed summary to give some context of where we are today. There's a lot to talk about, and not just about Gaza, but also the occupied West Bank and the rest of Palestine. And we're fortunate to be joined today by Diana Bhutu, a Palestinian human rights attorney and former advisor to the negotiating team of the PLO. She's joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Welcome to the Dropsite live stream, Diana. It's great to have you with us. Can you talk about these latest developments with Jared Kushner meeting with Khalil al-Haya and Netanyahu and where things stand right now?
Thank you, Sharif. Thank you. It's really nice to be back on the program again. Look, where things are standing is that this is an old Israeli tactic of renegotiating already existing agreements. Anybody who has followed Palestine long enough knows that Israel has never upheld any UN Security Council resolution, nor has it ever upheld any signed agreement. Instead, what it does is that it pushes people down the path. It says that it agrees to something and then goes down the path of using force, using violence, and then forcing the renegotiation and adding more and more and more conditions. This is exactly what we knew was going to happen back when the ceasefire agreement was signed back in October of 2025. As I mentioned then, and so many others did at the time, we were happy that the massive killing machine was going to stop, but we knew that it wasn't going to be over because we know Israel's approach, which is to add more conditions, to continue to renegotiate, to demand more time, and that feeds into Israel's hands to be able to continue off this killing machine, to be able to continue the killing. Now, from the beginning, Sharif, their slogan has always been, finish the job. You see it everywhere on bumper stickers inside Israeli cities, all over the place. And again, you're right, we don't know what that means. But what we do know is that this has been a process in which Israel has used this opportunity to continue the genocide. And under the guise of a so-called ceasefire agreement, everybody else is turned the other way. And yet Israel's killing machine still continues. So what they're doing now is they're using this new condition, this new pretext as an excuse to not only not stop the genocide, but as an excuse to not allow in reconstruction equipment, to not allow in food, to not allow in water, to not allow in medical supplies. These are massive war crimes, and they're being rubber stamped and approved by the United States.
Well, what about the position of the United States? I mean, you have President Trump, to much fanfare and his, you know, bombastic way, announcing on Truth Social that an agreement had been reached. Hamas did come to an agreement with mediators, for the first time, you know, agreeing in some manner to hand over its weapons, of course, giving very clear stipulations that Israel needed to fulfill its obligations. But then, you know, Israel and Netanyahu kind of just throw egg in the face of Trump and just flatly reject it. And then now we see, as has happened in the past, the Board of Peace and Trump, the Trump administration as well, simply adopting Israel's narrative and not standing by what itself announced. So what do you make of the United States' own position?
Well, the United States has been obviously complicit in this genocide. And the fact that they've been the ones who've been also agreeing to adding these conditions. You know, one of the things, Sharif, that I think people don't really realize is that what Israel is talking about in terms of disarmament is literally saying that Palestinians have no ability to protect themselves. Palestine doesn't have an army. We don't have nuclear weapons. We don't have any of those major weapons that Israel has. We're literally talking about just the things that people use to protect themselves. And what Israel's position is that unless every single revolver, every single bullet, every single everything is handed over with absolutely no means to protect ourselves, then they're not going to give food. Why is it that Palestinians should trust the very entity that's committed genocide by handing over any means to protect ourselves? And believe me, if it's not that, then it'll be yet another condition and yet another condition, yet another condition. What was agreed to was that everything would be handed over to a third party. And even that Israel won't agree to, because they like this, having this stretched out time. It gives them more time to kill more Palestinians, to steal more land, to make life unlivable in Gaza, and to make it so that people will, quote unquote, voluntarily leave, which is what they're ultimately looking for.
I mean, that's a very important point. When we talk about heavy weapons and weapons, Hamas doesn't even have any rockets left. Nothing. We're talking literally about AK-47s, repurposed, unexploded munitions from Israel that land in Gaza that they somehow put together to make very rudimentary weapons. But essentially what a Hamas leader told my colleague Jeremy Scahill several months ago is that they're talking about weapons of willpower. They're talking about surrender, actually. It's Absolutely. Not the danger of the actual weapon. It's a condition that you must give up resistance, essentially.
Absolutely. That's exactly what they're looking for.
And we also saw these eight countries, many in the region, but also Muslim majority countries, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the UAE, Egypt, Jordan, Qatar, Indonesia, and Pakistan, putting out a joint statement saying Israel now bears responsibility for obstructing the efforts to bring peace in Gaza, calling on the Board of Peace in the U.S. to take immediate and concrete measures to keep any party from obstructing the plan's implementation. You know, kind of milquetoast statement, but a rare rebuke from these countries. What do you make of that position?
I think that when this ceasefire agreement was signed, the reason that there were so many countries that signed onto it and supported it was for two reasons. One is they thought that the killing machine would stop. They were wrong. And two, they thought that this would lead to the immediate flooding of Gaza, those were their words, of medical supplies and reconstruction and so on. And of course, they're wrong on that too. And here we are 10 months later, we've seen over 1,200 Palestinians killed by Israel, including, as you already mentioned, 300 children. And we haven't seen any of this reconstruction equipment come in, or any reconstruction supplies or medical supplies. We still have bombed out hospitals. And so I think that the reason that they're now saying this is because they finally realized what Palestinians have been saying all along, which is that Israel doesn't want to stop. It has no intention of stopping. All that it intends to do is to be able to buy more time to ease that international pressure that was building all throughout 2025. They want to ease it so that they can continue genocide in the dark, effectively.
Well, I want to ask you also about the rest of Palestine, what's happening in the occupied West Bank right now. You know, we're seeing an even further escalation of attacks by Israeli settlers and soldiers. A lot of attention has been focused on currently on this village, Qusra, where Palestinian families have literally been placed under siege and are trapped in their homes by Israeli settlers who are backed by the Israeli military. You know, that we've seen these supposed statements of condemnation and hand-wringing by Israeli and U.S. officials yes. about these settlers, you know, who supposedly don't represent Israel. And, of course, they're still allowed to continue terrorizing these Palestinian families, some of whom are American citizens. One of them just flew back from Ohio to join his family members there. But can you explain what's happening there and also the rhetoric around it?
So what's happening now is exactly what happened in 1948, and it's exactly what happened in 1967, except this time people have cameras to document it. And what the Israeli settlers are doing is they're going into Palestinian lands, Palestinian homes, especially those areas that are slightly remote, and they're taking them over. they're taking them over because they know that the minute they take over a house or they take over a piece of land, that the army is going to protect them. And then from there, they can then build a settlement outpost. Once there's a settlement outpost, the state then gives them water, electricity, internet, you name it. And then once there's an outpost there with all of those amenities, after a few years, it becomes legalized. This is the history of practically each and every Israeli settlement. And so what the settlers have done is, because they've been given carte blanche to do whatever they want to do, they've been going after all of these areas in the West Bank, mostly remote, but now getting closer and closer and closer to major Palestinian cities. And Kusra is one of these towns that they are now going after. The aim is to try to block Palestinians from connecting with one another and to build a wide network, as wide of a network of Israeli settlements as possible. And then from there to prevent Palestinians from having a normal and decent life. It's not just the takeover of land, though, Sharif. They've been doing everything from cutting off water supply. This is from the state, by the way, to cutting off electricity, to also there have been major gasoline problems as well. And the aim of all of this, again, is to get Palestinians out of their home, to ethnically cleanse them. We've already seen that dozens of these towns have been ethnically cleansed, whether because of the direct action of the army or because of the settlers. And they've used everything from sexual violence to other forms of physical violence to get people out of their homes. And they know, the settlers know, that they operate with full impunity. The idea that somehow they're different from the state or separate from the state is laughable, because we've seen in Kusra, you can see the army standing right next to these Israeli settlers. We've seen that in the case of Palestinian, even of Palestinian Americans who've been killed by these settlers, including Saif Allah Musallat, who's killed last year, in July of last year. The Israelis know who are the settlers who are doing the killing, and yet they don't arrest anybody. So this is part and parcel. They're one and the same. To somehow claim that they're different is to try to somehow unscramble an egg, and you just can't do that.
Right. There was a UN commission of inquiry that put out a report in June that I'm just going to quote from it here. It said, "The participation of Israeli security forces in settler attacks amounts to a de facto collapse of the distinction between settlers and soldiers." And it went on to say that settler violence in the West Bank functions as a means of implementing Israeli state policy, with the state and violent settler groups and individuals working towards the same strategic objectives, including the maintenance of the occupation, the entrenchment of settlements, annexation of Palestinian territory, and displacement of Palestinians from their land. You know, that's the UN. This is what Palestinians have been saying for a long time. I also wanted to ask you about this news that we saw yesterday that I don't think has received enough attention, but this is in the territories occupied in 1948, you know, in Israel proper, in the city of Lod. There was an order by the Israeli authorities for 70 Palestinian families to leave their homes because they violated some, you know, supposed law, that they're seizing state land. So these are 70 Palestinian families, quite a large number in one order. Again, these are Palestinian citizens of Israel, and this is why various human rights groups and Palestinians have said for a long time that a state of apartheid exists between the river and the sea across historic Palestine. So these are Palestinian citizens of Israel who are being displaced from their homes in Lod. Can you talk about what that distinction is and what this order is about?
Yes, for sure. So in the aftermath of 1948, one of the first things that the Israeli state did was they took all Palestinian land that they had ethnically cleansed, and they put it in the hands of the state. So at current day, 93% of the lands of 48 Palestine, which is the land that was taken over in 1948 up until 1967, rests in the hands of the Israeli state, even though this had Palestinian owners. Why is this important? Because there are only three other countries around the world that have these high percentages: China, North Korea, and Cuba. what the Israelis are now doing is, because they're the ones who control this land, they are effectively deciding who can and cannot be on this land. And this is why it's not at all surprising that major human rights organizations and the UN have called Israel a system of apartheid, because it allocates land for people who are Jewish, but then somehow takes it away for people who are Palestinian. These current demolition orders, these orders to get these families out, what's new about it is that normally this takes place within a municipality. If somebody has violated a municipal order in terms of building, not building properly, or building outside of a map. This is now the first time that we're seeing that the state is coming in and demanding that people be kicked out of their homes. Why is it happening now? It's not at all surprising that in a 2.5 months' time, Sharif, there's going to be elections in the country. And in that 2.5 months' time, we're seeing that almost all of the Israeli political parties are running on platforms that are racist and fascist. Racist for sure, fascist a few of them. And so this feeds into it. You know, for each and every election, Palestinians are the ones who end up paying the ultimate price. And this is yet another way of the state showing that they're the ones who are in control and that Palestinians are going to be the ones who pay the price.
And finally, Diana, you know, we've seen over the past nearly 3 years now, genocide in Gaza, a rapid acceleration of attacks in the West Bank and across historic Palestine. And it's a very dark moment for Palestinians. But at the same time, do you have any hope, given what we're seeing in terms of politics happening in the United States, that Israel could not exist as an apartheid state, as a settler colonial state, without this backing from the US? It's, you know, armed and financed and enabled by the United States. And for the first time, we're seeing real changes in Washington towards Israel. We've seen, you know, over 100 Democratic Congress members vote against giving aid to Israel. It didn't pass, but that's happening. Being backed by the Israeli lobby, by AIPAC, is suddenly kind of a dirty word, and you can, you know, lose the election because of that. Do you have any hope that going forward things might ultimately change?
Look, I'm, you know, it's about time that the United States woke up and they finally see exactly where their taxpayer dollars are going, and they finally see that the U.S. has been funding and supporting a genocide. I certainly hope that this transforms and that this changes into policy change, because there needs to be policy change. Without that almost daily shipment of weapons from the United States to Israel, this genocide wouldn't have continued for as long as it has. And without that diplomatic support, we wouldn't have seen countries in Europe stepping up very quickly and also supporting Israel in the genocide. Now, there has been a shift, and this is why, in part, the Israelis were pushing for the ceasefire so that they could then shift public attention elsewhere. But it has to certainly be faster and much more sustained than it is now. The rate that Israel is going at now, particularly in Gaza, is more than alarming. And what they're doing in the West Bank is also more than alarming. When you see that people are thinking of leaving, and that the Palestinian Authority or doctors can't operate any longer, hospitals are on the verge of collapse, you see that this is a system that has been building for quite some time. And then I'm afraid that we're at the part where the ball is continuing to roll. So that change has to happen very, very, very quickly.
Well, Diana Butu, thank you very much. We're going to have you on soon again, I hope, to talk about what's happening. And of course, we're continuing to follow things as they develop on the ground at Dropsite. Diana Butu, Palestinian human rights attorney and former advisor to the negotiating team of the PLO. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sharif. Thank you.
We're going to turn now. I'm going to bring in my colleague, Julian Andrioni, who is closely following the primary races today in Florida. Julian, what's the latest? And tell us about who you're going to speak with today.
Yeah, well, we've seen this wave of Democratic primaries starting in March. The first Democratic primary for the 2026 midterms was in Texas. It was between James Tallarico and Jasmine Crockett. And we saw these little sprinklings, right, of what you were speaking about with Diana there, which is that AIPAC was becoming toxic. Any association with what was going on in Gaza or the genocide that Israel was conducting, apartheid elsewhere, was becoming toxic. And now we're in the final stretch of these primaries. And the one that's going to be happening, or one of the most significant ones that's going to be happening today, is in Florida. There are a couple Democratic incumbent Congress people, one of them being Jared Moskowitz in Florida's 25th district, and the other being Debbie Wasserman Schultz, now in Florida's 20th district, who are both ardently pro-Israel, both did not join those 100 Democrats or more than 100 Democrats who voted to withhold aid to Israel, and have been pretty consistent defenders of what's going on there to differing extents. But often they're, you know, when they soften their support for the genocide in Gaza, they are often doing so as a political calculation. And it becomes pretty clear because they're reciting talking points that other members of the Democratic establishment have clearly gotten from leadership. And so now we're going to have their two challengers. Oliver Larkin is challenging Jared Moskowitz in the 25th district, and Elijah Manley is challenging Debbie Wasserman Schultz in the 20th district. So we're going to have them both on at the same time here before polls close at 7 p.m. Eastern.
And just briefly before you bring them on, can you just explain a little bit about what we know about these two districts?
Yeah, well, Elijah Manley's district in the 20th district of Florida is a predominantly black district. It's become sort of controversial that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, after this redistricting that went on in Florida with the wave of gerrymandering that was happening across the country, has sort of parachuted into this district. She switched districts and is now running in a predominantly black area. And then the Florida's 25th district is 25% Jewish, typically understood to be more Zionist. And so Oliver Larkin is a DSA candidate who has been very outspoken about the genocide in Gaza. And it's going to be a really interesting test to see, you know, whether this type of ideology can hold up among a, you know, predominantly Jewish crowd. You know, we've seen in other areas like in New York, you know, Jewish New Yorkers supporting Zohran Mamdani more than they support Benjamin Netanyahu. It shows you that there are pretty stark differences between Judaism and Zionism. And so I think that Larkin's going to be putting that to the test in the 25th district. And then Manley, of course, is going to be trying to test whether the political establishment can go into any district in the country, regardless of the demographics, and try to sort of hang on tight to the power that they've held beforehand.
Okay, great. Well, let's bring them on and I'll leave you to speak with them.
Absolutely. Thanks, Sharif. All right, so there's Oliver Larkin, Florida's 25th, and then Elijah Manley there. He's going to be running in the 20th district. Guys, welcome to the Dropside stream, and how are you guys feeling ahead of Election Day?
Feeling good. I'm here at the polling location, so I promise I haven't been kidnapped or anything.
And Oliver, you're feeling good?
Yeah, I was just down at Sugar Sand Park in Boca Raton with one of our volunteers, and greeting people at polling locations. I'm going to be heading off to another polling location to do some Twitch streaming later on this morning. So trying to get out the vote and hearing a lot of good things from the ground. So hopefully we can get a good voter turnout today and make a lot of noise today.
You guys both talked about being on the ground. It's kind of the first thing I wanted to touch on here, because you guys are both being outspent. You guys are both facing opponents who are backed by the Democratic establishment in Washington and backed by the donor class. I wanted to hear you guys reflect a little bit, maybe not looking ahead to when the results roll in, but sort of looking back on the campaign that you guys have run. What are the types of strategies that these insurgent left campaigns need to deploy in order to beat that type of organized money and organized power? I'll kick it to Oliver first.
It's been our field organizing and having a really robust and active campaign schedule, with the candidate actually being out in the community, which is something that our 25th district has not had. Jared Moskowitz has not held a single public town hall since he was elected to office. That was actually one of the first moments that made it clear to me that there was an opportunity and a desire among the voters to see a new candidate that was going to actually be accountable to people. And that's what we've been doing with a grassroots campaign. We've made over 500,000 phone calls in just the last 2 weeks. We've knocked on over 40,000 doors. So having a really robust grassroots infrastructure with over 500 volunteers. And I think that's the kind of mobilization that a lot of Democratic primary voters, regardless of their personal ideology, are really inspired by. They love to see young people actually taking control and having some political agency in the process, because I think what we've seen is from the very start of this campaign, so many older voters, people who would go to the No Kings rallies and protests, they would tell me, where are the young people? Aren't they organizing? Don't they know there's fascism? Don't they know there's authoritarianism? And I would tell them, we are organizing. We're doing it in different spaces. We're doing it in places like the DSA chapters down here locally. So I think that convergence of bringing the DSA energy into the Democratic primary electorate on the heels of Mayor Mamdani's victory in New York City, I think has really given a lot of people some hope and optimism in a state that's been very few and far between in terms of giving some progressive injection into the electorate. So I think it's been that on the ground presence that is really responsive to people's issues about DOGE, about ICE, about the cost of living and getting corporate PAC money and AIPAC money out of our politics. That's really been the driving thrust of the momentum behind our campaign.
Yeah, I want to hear from Elijah as well, because I think, Elijah, yours is specifically interesting with regard to that strategy. I mean, that guerrilla tactic, right? Going down on the ground, casting a wide net, talking to as many people as possible, especially in your district that's predominantly Black. And you have this incumbent congresswoman from a different district who's white and is coming into this district and is going to try and hold on to the seat that she's occupying, but for a different constituency. Do you assess that sort of it's equally as significant or maybe more in your district to go and talk to people and tell them what's going on as opposed to just letting them learn about the race on their TVs or their, you know, their advertisements?
Yes, absolutely. By the way, I can't hear anything Oliver's saying, but I can hear you, Julian. So okay. It might just be a little tech issue there. But I think, you know, what I kind of gather from you and what I think Oliver is probably talking about as well, talking to as many people as possible. You know, I think that one thing, you know, obviously the left in general can learn from in electoral politics is, yes, to cast the widest net possible to bring people over. A lot of the people that are voting for me are not even progressives. Funny to say, a lot of people voting for me are moderates or centrist types who just believe that the Democratic Party is weak and they want strong leaders and loud voices as well. So, you know, I think that's extremely important in this moment, is to have people who can reach people, who can message. And those are the best type of people to have. What I've learned, you know, through this campaign trail is, you know, not to cast any assumptions about the voter, because you really never know where people are, where they're leaning. And, you know, so many people are undecided. So trying to reach as many of them as possible in many different ways, you know, whether it's mail, whether it's door to door, whether it's online, whether it's meeting them out where they are in the public, you know, you have to have like a wide range of ways to reach people. You know, obviously Florida is a little bit different from like New York and in other places in the country where, you know, things are a little bit more dense or people are a little bit more tuned in. This is a state where it's a lot of retiree voters, a lot of older voters, and usually the way you reach them is through mail, mail and ads. I think TV ads don't really move people that much, but I think mail does move people. So like one of the pieces of advice that I would give progressive campaigns is to send a lot of mail, because that does help. But nothing obviously replaces, you know, good old fashioned door knocking or calling people on their phones and saying hello to them. So, you know, that's one of the things I, you know, through this whole campaign process, I've learned is to reach out to everybody. Because most people be talked at, they don't want to be told what to do. People just want to be talked to and heard and feel like somebody you know, is listening to them and they have somebody's ear.
Right. Yeah, no, that's so that was the reason why I asked that question, because I think that in talking to candidates across the country, and I've interviewed both of you guys in DC, I think that that is the general theme. The way that you beat organized money and organized power is by simply going and meeting the people who those ads are going to be targeting. I think the elephant in the room here with both of your guys' races and why you guys are both on at the same time is because you guys are both challenging, you know, incumbent Democratic Congress people who are pro-Israel or who have at least expressed support for Israel in the past and are kind of tiptoeing around the issue in some respects, but also being pretty loud about their defense for what Israel is conducting in Gaza and in the West Bank and in southern Lebanon, Iran. And so I wanted to, let's ask Oliver first. I mean, your district, you know, is a generally understood to be a Zionist leaning district. I mean, are you worried about not only being able to challenge somebody who's been ardently pro-Israel, somebody who has a track record of supporting the nation state in the primary, but also are you kind of worried about electability if you are to beat, you know, Jared Moskowitz and maybe some of those Zionist Democrats are just not willing to get on board with a DSA candidate like we've seen with some of the, you know, past Haley Stevens supporters with Abdul El-Sayed winning the election there? I mean, generally, what's your view of the electorate and are you worried at all about that?
I think opinions on Israel are changing so quickly, especially after Democrats failed to defeat Donald Trump in 2024, when the Gaza genocide was something that many Democratic politicians, including President Biden and Vice President Harris, did not really acknowledge in a meaningful way. I think that public opinion has shifted so dramatically in recent years, and we've seen this in our polling of the old 23rd district where I originally began running, which carries over about 50% of the population into this new 25th district. And in the new 25th district, after Ron DeSantis and Florida Republicans illegally gerrymandered the maps, we ran a poll again in early May. And what we found in both of our polls in the old district and in the new district, and as well as more recently, the poll we just put out that showed this race in a dead heat, in all three polls, we found AIPAC is overwhelmingly unpopular. Nearly half of Democrats say that AIPAC support makes them less likely to support a candidate, followed by neutrality doesn't really move them. It's a vanishingly small number of people that are more likely to support a candidate because of their AIPAC support. The overwhelming amount of Democrats, as well as general election voters, including Republicans and non-party affiliated voters, want to see the United States at minimum place conditions based on international law to our military aid to Israel, and a very strong plurality of Democratic and independent voters and Republicans want to see the United States cease this aid entirely. Benjamin Netanyahu is less popular than Donald Trump in this district. So what we've found is that despite the very real ties and affinity that many people have with the nation state of Israel in this district, the actual facts on the ground are that people do not want to see our taxpayer dollars going towards a completely lawless regime that is really attacking human rights. It's committing genocide. It's committing apartheid. Some people might feel a little bit more squishy about using the genocide word or using the apartheid word, but we can all acknowledge these are disproportionate military actions. These are war crimes. This has targeted women and children. It's led to tens of thousands of needless civilian deaths. And I think that's something that many Jewish residents in our district find is not something they want to be associated with. We are all united by our common humanity, and Jewish South Floridians are also struggling with the cost of living, with the cost of property insurance. Gas is going up. Two-thirds of Americans find groceries to be unaffordable. So what we've found is that we actually have a tremendous amount of support within the Jewish community. I do not want to paint it as a monolith. Of course, there are Israel supporters. Of course, there are people who want to see this military aid continue. But looking at the district as a whole, I think this is the direction that the rest of the country is moving. And South Florida really is no different, even if the degree to which we're moving away from this unconditional support for Israel, you know, may be contested by Congressman Moskowitz. He's really tried to paint the community as a monolith. And of course, we recently just had the attempts by a Democratic state lawmaker, along with Laura Loomer and the Islamophobic, bigoted United States Congressman Randy Fine, attempt to cancel our rally with Representative Rashida Tlaib. The rally went forward. It was amazing. It was a fantastic turnout and incredibly galvanizing. So we see this attempted, you know, cancel culture because of our strong support for human rights and human dignity and abiding by both U.S. and international law. So I think this is a hotly contested issue. The Jewish community is divided. There's no question, but there's strong support for an anti-genocide, anti-apartheid politics that centers human rights. And to the degree to which that there may be Jewish South Floridians that still support Israel, they're Republicans. They're more likely than not going to vote for the Republican Party anyway. Within a Democratic primary electorate, there is much stronger movement in support of human rights and of wanting to see the United States really abide by both international international and United States law. So it's hotly contested, but I think there's enough support out there, including among the Jewish community, to make a real change.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I think anybody who grew up around Judaism, myself included, as somebody who converted when my mom married my stepdad and who was bar mitzvahed, I think knows that there are varying opinions and interpretations of religion within the Jewish religion. And that assessment from what you learn on the ground doesn't surprise me at all, you know, considering my own history with the religion. It's an overwhelmingly peaceful and critically thinking one. I wanted to ask Elijah really quickly about the Israel issue in his district. Elijah, I believe you're muted, but I just wanted to quickly just ask you, you know, do you think, and this is something we talked about in our prior interview, but I want to circle back here as you've had more time to campaign, especially given the elections today. I mean, do you think that do you sense passion around the issue of Israel in your district? And if you do you think it is rooted in this deep interest in foreign affairs and that these, you know, voters, working class voters in your district are super tuned in to what's going on the global stage? Or is it more of a microcosm or a litmus test for the corruption in politics, given the unpopularity of AIPAC? Are they sensing that people who are willing to sell out to, you know, a country that's committing a genocide, who are willing to take money from a country that is blatantly violating human rights and international law, that's paying legalized bribes to our politicians, are perhaps also not willing, you know, to vote for somebody who would accept those types of checks from the pharmaceutical industry or, you know, the big oil industry, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so I'll start definitely by saying this is the wrong district for them. This is not a pro-Israel district, especially right now. The voters, I think, in Florida 20 understand what's happening. And, you know, when I go out and meet people, I say at least one out of three people are like, you don't take money from AIPAC, right? And I'm like, no. Or they are upset at Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is obviously the AIPAC top dem. But, you know, I think in this district, people are more concerned about the affordability crisis. They know what's going on. Foreign policy is not the top of their list. So like the whole, like, you need to be pro-Israel thing just won't work in this district. And I think that's the frustration of the pro-Israel crowd, is they can't effectively make that argument against me in this district just because people don't really care. And the people that really care about this are going to be people who are like, yo, that's some effed up stuff happening over there. And those are the people that are going to be voting. And I think in this district too, there's a lot of liberal Jewish voters in this district too. I would say more so than anywhere else in the state, who, you know, really know what's happening. They understand what's happening and they're not down with that. And they don't want to have our faith just conflated with, you know, a foreign policy agenda of a foreign government. Oh, did we lose Julian? No, come back.
Elijah, you and I are hosting DropSite now.
Yeah, I'm back. Sorry about that, guys. I had Wi-Fi, but
you're back. I can't hear you now, but you're back.
Oliver, I've got your audio, Julian.
Okay. Well, if Elijah can't hear me, if Elijah can't hear me, it's a slight problem, but perhaps Oliver can relay some of it. And I think the last thing I wanted to get to were kind of specifics. Questions for each of you.
I can't hear a word you're saying, Julian, by the way.
I'll repeat it for you, Elijah, if you can hear me.
Yes. And so sorry about the technical difficulties. But first, I do have a question for Oliver. And Oliver, you know, Jared Moskowitz specifically is somebody who, yes, is understood more recently to be pro-Israel, but is somebody who during the early Trump years was perceived to be somebody who on the Oversight Committee and sometimes still on domestic issues is witty, is able to sort of highlight the humor and hypocrisy in what some of the Republicans are doing. And I think that some voters are kind of, you know, if they are acutely looking at politics along the left-right spectrum, will say, oh, well, this guy is hard on Trump, so I like the guy who's hard on Trump. And I wanted to ask you how you plan to differentiate yourself when it comes to oversight, investigation, enforcement of our laws, when you, or if and when you get into Congress in his place, what type of, how do you see your role on the oversight committee or on whatever committee you'd like to be on in enforcing some of our laws? And how would you juxtapose it with the way that Moskowitz is perceived in that respect? Somebody who's generally seen positively.
Yeah, that's a really great question, because I don't want voters to think that they might be losing a voice that they really value. And I think that's why I've had a prerogative to go into places like Fox News or Newsmax, like I did last night, or News Nation, like I did this morning, to show that I'm just as willing to go hard against Republicans and against Trump and his allies and the administration and the media as Jared Moskowitz is. And I think it's that really showing that fight, that this is not just about taking on a corporate Democrat for the sake of taking on a corporate Democrat, but because precisely I believe he's not adequately standing up for our values in the way that we need to fight back against this Republican Party. So I think that's actually been, I think, one of the biggest boons to our campaign is me going on Fox News and me going into these more conservative media spaces and showing that I can hold my own and showing that I can throw a punch the same way that I would in House Oversight Committee hearings or in House Judiciary or on whichever committee I'm placed on, that I can adeptly handle myself and question and interrogate and cross-examine Trump administration officials, cabinet secretaries, witnesses that are called before Congress. And one key distinction that I want to make, because I think that as much as Congressman Moskowitz has created this profile for himself, taking on Pam Bondi or Kristi Noem in Congress, it's always been with the slight implication that Donald Trump cannot fail. He can only be failed. When we look at Kristi Noem, it was look at how incompetently she was carrying out the Trump administration's policy. They can't even build the border wall correctly. With Pam Bondi, it was, Mr. President, you were the host of The Apprentice. Think of the ratings if you told Attorney General Pam Bondi she's fired. I think it's that kind of, you know, still trying to be a little bit too cute with it. This is someone who was regarded as a potential nominee, the only Democratic potential nominee for Trump's cabinet as FEMA secretary after, at Matt Gaetz's personal recommendation, Ron DeSantis appointed Jared Moskowitz to that position at the state level with the Florida Department of Emergency Management. So I understand that a lot of Democratic voters that may come across Congressman Moskowitz on other social media platforms, seeing his cross-examination in House committee hearings, I think that's precisely why he's been willing to go on Fox News. So I'm willing to go on Fox News, and I will be just as, if not even more, effective in taking the fight to them and exposing the Republican Party's hypocrisy, because this is ultimately a toss-up district, and I'm going to need to show that I'm just as capable of taking on the Republican nominee after today as I am of taking on Congressman Moskowitz, because voters in this district really want to rest assured that we can keep this seat blue and that we're presenting the strongest possible argument for uniting the Democratic Party base and bringing in non-party affiliated voters that may be more disaffected with the corporate establishment wing of the Democratic Party, that we can actually build a bigger coalition that's capable of winning the seat in November and then being really effective once we're in office of taking the fight to the Republican Party and this administration.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, it's sort of like a trade-off, right? Like, you get the humor and you get somebody who's able to like make light of the hypocrisy of the Trump administration, but then you also get somebody who, in your words, is being a little cute with it and is thus potentially sane-washing something that should be taken quite seriously, which is a rise towards fascism, authoritarianism, etc. Can Elijah, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's a record heat today.
What he said over there.
Oh, Oliver.
I can hear you.
Oh, you can hear me. Okay, good.
No, I can hear you.
Okay, excellent. Because I do have one more question for you, and then I'm going to kick it to Sharif. I just wanted to ask you generally, I mean, specifically with regard to Debbie Wasserman Schultz, I mean, she is somebody who was chair of the DNC. She's somebody who has been in Congress before that and then has been in Congress after that. She's somebody who knows Washington well. She knows her way around the building. How are you going to get a jump start, not only as somebody who's voting on the legislation, but somebody who can be an operator, an organizer in office, like you guys both talked about, being on the ground, getting public support for these issues that you guys care about? but within the halls of power, and sort of catch up to where she's at with her comfortability within the building and within the institution.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I think everybody has to start somewhere. There was a time when Debbie Wasserman Schultz was a freshman, when she was 25 years old and she was first elected to public office. And, you know, there will be a time when I'm a freshman in January. And, you know, there will be mentors. There will be people to help guide me through that process. But I think I'm a smart and intelligent person. I can find my way through the halls of Congress. And similarly, like Maxwell Frost did, you know, he got into office and he hit the ground running pretty quickly. And some people were surprised. I was not surprised because he's a very smart guy. And so I think similarly here, you know, when I get in there, it's all about building relationships with people, finding, you know, what people care about there and trying to work together with people on the things that we share. But also at the end of the day, I think, you know, there is a common agenda, and there are going to be a lot of people who share the same agenda as me when we get there in January. There's going to be a big, you know, expansion of progressives and conquerors come January. We're going to be working together on the same legislation, and that's what I intend to do. And whether that's legislation, bills usually don't make it through Congress anyways for nobody, so because we have such gridlock, whether that's bringing dollars home, appropriation dollars, every member of Congress gets 15 projects. I know there's this talking point in my district where Debbie, you know, everyone thinks, oh, because she's so senior, she gets to bring more money, which is not the case. You know, every member of Congress gets to, you know, sponsor 15 projects for their district. Some people do 5, some people do 15, but I will do the full 15. And because I understand and I know my district more than Debbie Wasserman Schultz does, I know where that money needs to go. I know which streets need to be, you know, the infrastructure and what parts of the district need to be repaired quicker. I know what schools need the most money, which healthcare, where we lack healthcare options in the district, what I call healthcare deserts. So just having that lived experience on the Hill is more important than just having, you know, somebody having seniority just for the sake of having seniority. Or if it's in committee, you know, speaking up in a way against the Trump administration. We haven't seen Debbie Wasserman Schultz really do that. She's been kind of a backbencher power player, but she hasn't really used that power to really do anything or to speak up. You know, it's great to send a strongly worded letter or a press release or to go on the news and say you don't like what they're doing and put out a platitude. But at the end of the day, what are you doing? You know, are you putting your body on the line? Are you showing up? Are you speaking up when it really matters about the things that really matter to the people? So when I get there, you know, I don't know what committees I'm going to be on. I know which committees I want to be on. But wherever I am, I'm going to dig my heels. Well, I don't wear heels, but I'm going to dig my boots into the ground, and I'm going to work for my constituents.
Well, Elijah, Oliver, thank you so much for joining us on this very busy primary day for you guys. And and we're looking forward to seeing, you know, those results roll in. I think, as I said, polls close 7 p.m. Eastern local. I think we'll all have, you know, hopefully some TV show on, you know, Abby Phillips, CNN, or maybe the Steve Kornacki, MSNBC, or maybe Fox News, and you just watch the, you know, the maps develop. So we'll see your guys' faces and sort of a big profile on screen. And thanks so much for joining us on Dropside this morning beforehand.
Thank you, Julian.
Absolutely. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, guys. So now I'm going to kick it back to Sharif, and we will do the last segment here.
Thanks, Julian. And yeah, I'd encourage everyone to check out our social media, Dropside social media on X and elsewhere, to follow the results where our maestro Herman Gill leads our team there. And Julian also will be covering it, so we can see the results come in. But today, we're going to end today by looking at the case of a Los Angeles family. A mother, Mariam Tahmasabi, a father, Isa Hashemi, and their 16-year-old son. They are all legal permanent residents of the United States with valid green cards. And all three were arrested in April by ICE, and they've been held in immigration detention in Texas since then. The father, Isa, in one prison, and the mother and son in another. And they're being detained apparently because Aisa's mother was a translator for the Iranian hostage takers in 1979, nearly 50 years ago. Nothing more than that. So the mother, Maryam, wrote a moving article for The Nation magazine from detention that was published last week. And I just want to read a short clip excerpt of it. She said, quote, Imagine that you're an independent woman wading through the waters of sexism and patriarchy every day. And then you're told that not only do your own ideas and academic achievements not matter, but you are somehow now responsible for decisions you never made and for things that happened before you were ever born, that you don't have an identity of your own, and that your existence can be negated based on relations. This is bloodline punishment. I was hoping that the United States of America, the country that I loved, would be different. End quote. Those are the words of Mariam Tahmasabi in The Nation. For more on the case, we're joined by two members of Mariam's legal team, Maria Kari and Tala Al-Fokaha. Welcome to DropSite's live stream. Tala, let's begin with you. Can you just lay out the case? What happened? How was this family picked up? And why are they being held in immigration detention?
Hi, Sharif, and thank you so much for having me on and uplifting this really terrible but really important and chilling story. So, just to reiterate, Mariam, Issa, and their 16-year-old son are a family of lawful permanent residents who have lived in the United States, worked in the United States for nearly 12 years. Mariam and Issa are both professors, and their son is 16 years old. And they have now been held in ICE detention for over 130 days. And they were targeted by the Trump administration, not on the basis of what they've done, but on the unconstitutional and discriminatory basis of who they are. I think this is really a story about a family of people who have, again, done everything right. They entered the United States lawfully. They worked in the United States lawfully. They've never had a criminal charge. They lawfully adjusted status to become green card holders in 2016. And still they were detained after a change.org petition and an online smear campaign began targeting them on the basis of a family relation of theirs. And in the case of their son, this is on the basis of his grandmother. And in the case of Mariam, this is on the basis of her mother-in-law. And on that basis, after this change.org petition was launched, after they became the target of a relentless smear campaign, the Trump administration arrested, detained, and shipped them over 1,000 miles away from their home to detention centers in Texas with no warning, no notice. I believe Mariam talks about this in her op-ed, but she thought her husband had been kidnapped because he didn't go to pick up their son from school that day. And the next morning, Mariam and her son were detained outside of their house while Mariam was driving her son on the way to school. So really, you know, detained in this sort of extrajudicial fashion, in a really dystopian and chilling manner. And I think this case, you know, represents the Trump administration's latest attack on immigrants, on people of Iranian descent. It's a racially motivated detention, and it really demonstrates the Trump administration turning its repressive power inwards in a way that's reminiscent of the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Truly solely on the basis of their identity and not on the basis of anything that they have done. So, in brief, that's what this case is about, and it truly should outrage us all.
But what have the authorities said about the reason for their detention? They are, as you mentioned, legal residents of the United States. They have not committed any crimes, and they're not being charged with any crimes. What are they ostensibly saying is the reason?
Yeah, so they've been charged on the sole basis of a very rarely used provision of our immigration laws, saying that their presence or activities in the United States might pose a threat to the foreign policy interests of the United States, or might compromise a compelling foreign policy interest of the United States.
This is what was claimed, used against Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University graduate, who was kind of the first test case of this, it seems.
Exactly. And so you can see sort of a pattern of online smear campaigns where people are calling on the Trump administration to deport individuals, translating into actual arrests and detentions and attempted deportations. So it's on the basis of that foreign policy ground provision that they were targeted. And the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, personally issued a memorandum citing, again, only their parents as the basis for their arrest and detention, did not provide any other basis. And I think one thing that gets lost in the discussion of the foreign policy ground or this case is that the government has actually already conceded that Mariam Issa and their son were detained on the basis of their lawful speech and associations. In order for the government, in order for Secretary of State Marco Rubio to invoke this provision and issue this sort of memorandum declaring them to be people who would compromise U.S. foreign policy interests, a different provision of the INA, that's INA section 212A3C3, says that the Secretary of State must personally determine or must issue this sort of determination in cases where someone's past, current, or expected belief statements or associations would be lawful in the United States. So in order for the Secretary of State to issue this sort of determination, the government is already conceding that their speech, their associations, their activities are lawful in the United States. The government is just saying that these lawful speech and associations compromise a U.S. foreign policy interest. And of course, you know, that phrase is so ill-defined that it could mean anything, use anything, be mobilized against anyone. And that's what we're seeing, you know, from, you know, beginning to be used against advocates for Palestinian rights and now being used more broadly against, you know, any individual that could conceivably, in the eyes of the Trump administration, carry an identity that is one that they want to target.
And Maria, what's happening in terms of advocacy for their case? Have their representatives, their Los Angeles-based family, have their representatives spoken out about this? Senators, what's happening in Washington and advocacy around their plight?
Yeah, so the members of the Iranian diaspora that sort of started a witch hunt to draw the government's attention to this case did so through a change.org petition. That petition, unfortunately, is still up despite our legal team's repeated requests to get it taken down. Unfortunately, as a result of this petition, you see the likes of...
Can you just outline what did the petition say exactly?
The change.org petition singled out this family, saying that they're living a so-called life of luxury here in the U.S. And they should be detained and deported because of their connections to relatives that serve in the IRGC. This was done for several Iranian families living here lawfully in the U.S. And our clients were one of those families. Now, under ordinary circumstances, these petitions would circulate in some corner of the internet and nobody would pay them any mind. Certain members of the Iranian diaspora had tried to do similar petitions and make similar efforts under the first Trump administration and then under the Biden administration and had gotten nowhere with that. Under this administration, because like Tala described, we've seen a resurgence of the foreign policy grounds being used to go after unpopular groups. What we saw is that this change.org petition gets the attention of the likes of Leo Terrell, who's the senior counsel at the DOJ. Representative Randy Fine, your previous guest, was talking about how he's known as a, you know, a hate monger, Islamophobic individual, who then start flagging the Secretary of State. And it's very interesting when you see the timing, the day of Issa's arrest, you see that the green card is revoked, Issa is arrested, and within a couple of hours, before Mariam even fully understands and can grapple with where her husband has disappeared to, Fox News is running a segment on this. So this is very orchestrated by the government. Now, under the foreign policy grounds, if the Secretary of State wants to invoke it, there is a notice, a congressional notice requirement. Congress has to be notified. In all of these cases, going back to when we first saw the foreign policy grounds being used to target people, including Mahmoud Khalil, we have not seen the Trump administration notify members of Congress and kind of get that permission. Unfortunately, some courts have held that this extraordinary power that Secretary of State Marco Rubio has to detain people is valid, but it's still being tested out in court. Congress has a huge role to play here because of that, because the courts are still grappling with this extraordinary power. Congress needs to hold the line. One of the things I find interesting is that Senator Padilla, who, you know, Mariam and Issa and their child are constituents of Senator Padilla, he has put forward the NOPE Act, N-O-P-E, and that piece of legislation actually targets the foreign policy ground not being used to go after people the Trump administration doesn't like. So Senator Padilla is engaged on this issue. Unfortunately, we have a situation here, though, that despite, you know, certain members of our elected representatives doing the things that they need to in terms of platitudes and letters of support and condemning these sort of extrajudicial kidnappings of their constituents, they're not doing more. They need to do more. They can do more. You know, I'm thinking about Senator Van Hollen, who got on a plane when Kilmar Brigo-Garcia was unlawfully rendered out of this country. And I'm thinking of when Ramiza Ozturk was taken. You had members of Congress, you had senators write to the State Department and demand to know the evidence that was used under which basis the likes of Ozturk and Khalil and Mohsen Mehdavi are being targeted. That's the sort of action that Congress needs to do right now. We really need our representatives to hold the line because the Trump administration is acting in a completely unlawful way. We are now in the business of jailing people for who they're related to, right? Like Tala described perfectly, we have gone from targeting what somebody said and did to now targeting for who they're related to. And that is profoundly un-American.
What do we understand of their conditions of detention? As we mentioned, they've been separated. Issa's in one prison, Mariam and her son are in another. What do we know of their conditions? And we do know that family separation has been a longstanding policy of immigration detention. But have they tried to request, have you tried as a legal team to request that they be at least held in the same place?
Yeah, repeated attempts with their representatives, with Senator Padilla's office. We've repeatedly requested that their offices intervene and get this family reunified. And they're about 15 minutes down the street from one another. So here's what's going on with the child, right? There's a Flores settlement agreement. That's a law that says that children should not be held in detention centers past a certain point. We're now, I think, something like 7 times over that legal limit that this child has been held, right? So that's completely illegal, but it happens all the time. Dili is now notorious for keeping children detained for upwards of a year. This child should be going back to school, right? And instead, he's fallen behind in his education. He made one friend who was 16 like him. That friend was recently deported. This child has now taken to naming some of the stray cats at the facility. That's really his only source of entertainment, he tells me. And he didn't see or talk to his father for months. That was his first time going that long without being with his father. And the mental toll of that is unspeakable, right? We speak of the trauma of these conditions, but imagine that compounded with the age of this kid. His mom is a psychologist, this brilliant woman, this professor of psychology, and she says to us that she's doing her best to help her son work through this, but it's getting increasingly hard because her own mental health is also so strained under the conditions. One of the things I found really interesting is that the conditions seem to fluctuate. So if there's a congressional visit that's planned, they'll get a piece of fresh fruit. They'll get fresh produce. Otherwise, it's all processed, unhealthy, inedible food. If they want clean water, they're spending tons of money to buy it because the water otherwise is not potable. It's got literal dirt and worms in it. So these are the conditions that these children are in. And of course, school. They've been out of school. He should have been going back to school. The schooling resources that are available there are for very young children, and he's in high school. So despite our repeated attempts to get this family reunified, to get this child out, none of that has been given any credence to by the Department of Homeland Security, which is a total shame and tells you that immigration detention system in this country is strictly punitive, right? It's a civil system, so it's not meant to be punitive. It's not like the criminal justice system. So why are we punishing people through the immigration courts? And that's really what's happening in here. And I go see clients in federal courts in federal prisons routinely. And I can tell you there is no functional difference between a federal prison that houses criminals and so-called ICE facilities that house children.
Yeah, and I just want to remind people that the treatment by ICE and in immigration detention, it's so horrific that over 50 people have died since in Trump's second term, since he came to office, in ICE detention. So since January of last year through to June, at least over 50 people have died. This question is for either of you, but as far as I understand, and what Mariam wrote in the Nation article, was that they even made the difficult decision after, I'm not sure after how long, to voluntarily leave the United States because they saw that they weren't going to get justice or be released. And yet the government's refusing to let them go and is insisting on detaining them. What is going on?
Yeah, so I can speak to that. So as you said, to Mariam, to Aisa, the United States is their home. To their son, he came here when he was 5 years old. It is the place that he has grown up. It's the place that they've lived and worked and built their lives. And the conditions of detention pushed them to seek pre-conclusion voluntary departure in their cases. And given the way that their cases are set up in the immigration court, Aisa's case is procedurally separate and different from Mariam and her son's case. And so they sought the court's permission to voluntarily depart before their removal proceedings reached a conclusion. And yes, as you said, in all cases, in the three of their cases, the government opposed their requests to do so, which, just taking a step back at how ridiculous that is, the government is ostensibly holding them because they want to remove them from the United States. And the law says that there must be a legitimate government purpose for them to detain people in when it comes to immigration detention. It cannot be punitive, as Maria said, and it must be related to the purposes of, the removal proceeding. And here you have the family agreeing to leave the United States and the government refusing those requests and continuing to hold them.
Where would they go?
So they're seeking a third country departure to a third safe country. That is what they were hoping to do. Aisa had his voluntary departure request granted by the court, despite the government's opposition. And Mariam and their son had their request denied. So now their cases, in addition to their physical separation, their cases are procedurally distinct. They're at different stages. Despite Aisa being granted voluntary departure, DHS reserved the right to appeal, and he remains in detention to this day, as do, of course, Mariam and their son.
So I would just add to that, there was like a surreal moment in immigration court where the government tried to argue when the topic of voluntary departure came up, which essentially just means that, we leave on our own, we pack our bags, we buy our own tickets, and not at the expense of the taxpayer, we leave. You want us to go, we leave. When that was brought up, the government tried to argue that it's a no because they're dangerous. Well, first of all, they've never put forward an iota of evidence that they pose any sort of danger to anybody, to their communities. In fact, to the contrary, we've gotten hundreds and thousands of messages and letters of support from people who want to speak about how amazing this family is and how deeply embedded they are because they're both professors at local community colleges in LA. the judge looked at the government's attorney and said, but they're trying to go. So it really just goes back to, well, what is the purpose then of their ongoing detention? Why do you have a family caged for over 4 months in these conditions, right? And how far is the government going to take this? Because if what we're opening the floodgates to is now jailing anybody whose family member once served in a government overseas, well, that's a whole lot of people, especially in a country like Iran, right, which has mandatory military service. So you have a lot of Americans of Iranian descent living in this country who will have a family member who served in some level of government back home. So are we now opening the threat of detention and deportation to all those individuals? And you hear this by the Fox News commentators, right? I was listening to a clip from the day that they were arrested. I was listening to that this morning, and you can see them gleefully talking about how, well, we have a lot of students on our campuses of Chinese origin and the Russians. Where are we taking the foreign policy grounds? I think that's the question that every American needs to be grappling with. How are we bringing back this obscure law from the dead and weaponizing it to go against the people that this government does not like?
One quick statistic I just want to jump in with that I think really illustrates the point of how obscure this law is and how unprecedented this shift in its usage has been is prior to March 2025, this law had only been the single ground of detention or the single ground used to detain an individual in immigration proceedings in one case in the many decades of its existence and the many millions of cases brought against immigrants in the United States. So it was only used one time to detain someone in removal proceedings as the sole charge brought. And since then, it's been used in a wide variety of cases and as a means to detain people also. Like that, the detention is the goal, is what we're seeing as well.
And that just one a couple... case was decided by President Trump's sister. That was the judge.
Right. Well, just a couple of quick questions before we wrap. On that precedent, as far as I understand, Mahmoud Khalil did win some... challenge to using that obscure law as the basis for his detention. He's still fighting, I think, a habeas corpus or something about his immigration. He can still be deported, but it didn't seem that the government got a victory in court around this, yet they're still able to use this provision.
So what I'll say is that, the government has used this case, this provision in multiple cases as it relates to different people, including students who advocated for Palestine. Mahmoud Khalil's case is one of them. On the district court level, he was released from detention on the basis of the judge finding, substantial likelihood of success on the free speech claims, on the other claims that challenged the government's usage of this provision. The case was then appealed, and the government is challenging nearly all of these cases on jurisdictional grounds, saying that federal courts actually do not have jurisdiction to hear habeas challenges to unlawful, unconstitutional detention in these sorts of cases where the foreign policy ground is being used on the basis of free speech. And in those cases on appeal, in some circuits, including Mahmoud Khalil's case, the government has been successful in arguing that federal courts don't have jurisdiction to hear that claim or those sorts of claims. So these cases are being actively litigated across the country. The government's strategy is to say that federal courts don't have jurisdiction to hear these claims, regardless of the actual merit and the substance of these claims, that this provision is unconstitutional. The government is arguing just that, regardless of that, federal courts don't have jurisdiction, and to mixed results. There are circuits that have ruled in along with the government, circuits that have ruled against, in a few of those circuits, there's still room for appeal even to like the full circuit court. So that's how the government is still able to use it. It's a strategy of bringing it in cases across the country, appealing it, and arguing this draconian sort of argument that courts should not even be able to hear claims of unconstitutional detention when the foreign policy ground is involved. And you can just imagine the sort of downstream consequences of that sort of argument if you don't have the right to challenge your unconstitutional detention in a federal court. And the flip side of that would be because of DHS regulations, not immigration laws, but DHS regulations saying that when someone is charged with a foreign policy ground, they are not eligible to have immigration bond set by an immigration judge. So they're not eligible to be released on bond. The practical effect of that would be that when someone is detained on the basis of their speech pursuant to the foreign policy ground, if the government was to have its way with its arguments in federal court, that these claims could not be reviewed in federal court or an immigration court in relation to their detention.
And when can we expect, when do they expect for this to be, this case to be heard before a judge? What are we waiting for, and what are the potential outcomes?
Yeah, so I will say that another tactic of the Trump administration is flooding the courts with these sorts of cases. And, you know, as we all know, justice delayed is justice denied. And that's what we're seeing here. So our judge in this case has notified petitioners in who filed habeas cases before him that he has been assigned over 400 habeas cases since January of 2026. Now, that's a result of the Trump administration's increase in immigration arrests and detentions, and it's really unprecedented numbers. And so because of that backlog, claims are taking a lot longer to be heard before judges. So, you know, the habeas petition was filed early after their detention. We recently also filed a bail motion to sort of continue to push their case before the judge. But there is such a backlog in these sort of petitions that are being filed that it's hard to say when we will get a decision, but that's a tactic as well, is to overload the courts and delay decisions in these sorts of cases.
And to add to that tactic, the other tactic is moving them, right? We saw this starting with Mahmoud Khalil. You spirit them away across the borders to less favorable jurisdictions. This family is from LA. That's where their community is. That's where their home has been for over a decade. What are they doing in Texas? It's because the Fifth Circuit has some of the worst immigration laws in this country. And that's the immigration court you want to be putting people through when you're the government. And, you know, just to give context, like, we're working on a lot of these types of cases. I have one client who's been now in prison for almost 9 months. That's how long the habeas has been pending. And it's really to no fault of anybody, except for the fact that, like Tala said, that the system is inundated with families and individuals who've committed no crime. I mean, Mariam and Issa say they've never even gotten a speeding ticket, and yet they're being treated like criminals and still waiting for their day in court over 130 days later.
And just finally, if people want to follow the case or get involved, is there somewhere they can go?
Yeah, there's a fundraiser for the Family's Legal Defense Fund, and just to also help keep the family afloat. You know, one of the things that I think gets missed in the conversation about when a family or a person is yanked off the streets by ICE, there's a lot of fallout that happens. So Mariam spoke recently to me about, I wonder what happened to my students. I wonder what the school told them about where I've gone. She was deeply attached to her students. So they're still paying rent on their home, despite the media and certain members of the Iranian diaspora claiming that this family was living a life of luxury. They were just a middle-class family who were renting an apartment. Donating is one of the best ways you can support people in this type of situation. They're forced to go to the commissary for something that's even remotely healthy. Phone calls are very expensive from inside the facility. So that sort of thing, donating to funds is always welcome. Write to your Congress, right? Like, Congress really needs to be holding the line here. You need to call your representative and ask what they are doing about the fact that a child is sitting in a prison instead of in school for over 7 times the legal limit. What are we doing here? This is profoundly un-American, and we need to be holding our representatives to account here, right? I know that the average person is not going to be able to sway or change or get in touch with the likes of DHS or state or the other agencies involved in this case. There's no influence there to be had, but there is in the people that we vote into positions of power, the people whose salaries we pay, and they need to be doing something for the children and for the families that are being targeted, that are their constituents. So that's absolutely a way to support it. And then, you know, we all just amplify the story. I think that humanizing these individuals so that people can see that these people are not criminals. This is not the so-called worst of the worst that we're yanking off the streets, but just real good, honest, hardworking, tax-paying Americans, you know, amplify their stories.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll also say that I think it's really important that we don't get desensitized to these sorts of situations and these stories, because I think given the huge increase in arrests and detentions, you know, this news cycle has become a little normalized of people being yanked off the streets, shipped away hundreds to thousands of miles from their homes. And I think it's, again, really important that we continue to share these stories when we see them, amplify it, build, you know, grassroots bases of support to protect our communities, to support people when they are in detention. And as Maria said, like, whether it be from supporting with the commissary or writing to members of Congress, it's just really, really important that we don't get desensitized. And I think if people focus on the mother, the mother-in-law, the grandmother in this case, they're really losing focus on what this case is actually about, which is one, you know, an instance of the Trump administration exploiting the divisions and the grief in the Iranian community right now, but two, also, you know, a situation where our most fundamental rights to due process, to speech, to association, to equal protection under law based on our national origin are being assaulted. And if this can happen to them, it can truly happen to anyone. And I think it's very important that we all keep that in mind.
Well, we'll continue to follow the case at DropSite and provide any updates as they come. Thank you both very much for joining us today, Tala and Maria, for your work on the case as well.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That does it for this live stream. We are here Tuesdays at 9:30 a.m. Eastern. If you want to support our work, you can subscribe at dropsidenews.com. You can also make a 501c3 tax deductible donation to our work by going to dropsidenews.com and clicking on ways to give. You can also subscribe to us on social media, on X, on Instagram, and on YouTube. Make sure to follow us on those social media platforms. Let people know about our work. On behalf of everyone at DropSite, thanks for joining us. I'm Sherif Abdelkoudous.